Why did you offer juice and wine if you see you
I think she's doing very well, don't you? The quality of Egyptian linen was prized and sold at very high profits.
Plini Rice, Egyptio lino, minimum firmitatis, plurimum lucri.
A linen very soft, of a very high price. The textile factories were under the direct supervision of the local government, and the workers were inscribed in a corporation for the purpose of maintaining a production monopoly and assuring a constantly high quality. Linen was woven in pieces of 20 meters by 1.70 meters, more or less. Pieces of linen were regularly exported everywhere in the Mediterranean area, including Palestine. The Rossellini expedition in Egypt has discovered many papyri showing the various phases of flax manufacture. After weaving, the piece of linen was washed in boiling water, in which was added
Papaverum Heracleum or Saponario officinalis, as is stated by Theophrastus in his Historia Plantarum. Theophrastus says that papaverum is very similar to saponaria.
After that treatment, the linen became beautifully white and clean. One peculiarity of the shroud is the technique used in the weaving, a herringbone technique. This requires very advanced technology compared with what we know was in use 2,000 years ago. The hand loom must be provided with special combs,
lychee,
into which the threads of the warp are inserted alternately so that the shuttle passes not under one single thread but at least under two or four, following the design required so as to obtain a diagonal effect. This technical peculiarity found on the shroud caused great perplexity concerning the antiquity of the cloth. However, certain discoveries have been made and their dating may help us. The herringbone weaving technique first appeared in Europe during the so-called Hallstatt civilization of the 7th century BC. Professor Hunt has reproduced these finds in his work
Textile Reste aus dem Hochmichel.
There are some textiles with a simple diagonal weaving and others with a herringbone weaving very similar to that of the shroud. Other samples have been found in Britain, in a grave at Colchester, probably of the year 60 BC, and others, woven in wool, at Chesterholm. Other finds came from the caves of Murabat, geographically nearer to the site of our studies. However, the most important discoveries concerning funerary cloths are from
Antinoopolis, Egypt,
a town founded in the year 130 AC, which rapidly became a center of a very rich Hellenistic lifestyle. An extensive and well-preserved necropolis was found and excavated, providing an enormous amount of catalog materials, some of them similar to the shroud in shape. Among them, there are two funerary cushions, which must have belonged to persons of importance. They were two women. The first one was covered with a death mask,
surmonté de la haute coiffure à boucles que portait l'impératrice Sabina, says Guimet. Vivia Sabina
died in the year 137. This helps us to date the grave and the cushions. This is important because the cushions are covered with a cloth woven with the same herringbone technique. One other similar piece of line, and this is like flax, it doesn't mean linen, she says, was discovered in Italy at
Ercolanum, the town covered by the ashes of Vesuvius, in the year 79 BC. Antinoopolis and Ercolanum
were well-known residential centers whose villas were inhabited by selected people. It is therefore quite possible that a linen corresponding to the technical data of the shroud should have been sold in Jerusalem at that time. Let us take a brief look at the various discoveries concerning the old tombs in Jerusalem and in the diaspora, which might be contemporary with the shroud. These tombs in Jerusalem and, for instance, in the Jewish catacombs in
Roma, Villa Torlonia and Sant'Agnese,
are all excavated or hewn in rock. The places chosen were always as dry as possible. They look like rooms, often containing places for many burials, from two or 20 or more. Sometimes there is an entrance chamber and a second one where the corpses were buried. We find stone sarcophagi, sometimes decorated, or
loculi, hewn into the walls, coquim,
You see, if you say opera duette. Or else a pit in the center of the room, or benches along the walls. Sometimes the four types are found together, as in the burial caves of Mount Scopus at Jerusalem. The imprint we see on the shroud is that of a man lying in rigor mortis on a horizontal bench with something, a stone, a cushion, under his head. This position is in no way contradictory to all that we know about the old Jewish tombs. The excavations carried out by the Pontificia Commissione di Archeologia in the Jewish Catacombs of Villa Torlonia in Rome brought to light many well-preserved tombs in which a brown, oily coating, a patina, was found. It was clear that this was spices and perfumes. But the most interesting discovery, because of its bearing on the shroud and the Gospels, was that the inside of the tombs, the benches, the walls, the ceiling, the floor, were plentifully sprinkled with these funerary spices. Villa Torlonia tombs probably belonged to poor Jewish families. Nevertheless, the quantity of spices spread over and around the bodies was enormous. One other piece of information is of some historical interest in this connection. In the year 1853, a French pilgrim, Louis Bunel, visited the Holy Land and the sepulcher. A Greek monk told him of the fire of 1808 and of the restoration the Greek carried out with the permission of the Turkish government. The Turkish laws recognized a building as belonging to whomever had restored it. Bunel says that the Greeks restored the church and the sepulcher according to their own plans and removed the stones over the tomb. As they did this, they noticed a persistent and inebriating perfume of spices. All these discoveries bring us to the debated point concerning the quantity and the nature of the spices which were in contact with the shroud. We believe that the man of the shroud was buried in a dangerous, hurried, and makeshift condition, awaiting a second, ritually complete stage of burial after the repose of the imminent Sabbath. In fact, the body, against all the ritual prescriptions, was naked and dirty. The imprints show us the situation clearly. Nowhere in the geographical area linked with this research has any shroud in similar condition been found. In the necropolis of Antinoopolis, only two funerary shrouds bore a vague imprint of the face, get that, due to the reaction of resinous spices.
It's very important for our studies, this imprint found in Antinoopolis.
None carried the imprint of the body because they were normally washed and dressed, as it was the universal Jewish custom. The Gospel of John says that Joseph and Nicodemus wrapped the body in linen cloths with the spices. The Gospel of Mark says that the women brought spices to anoint the body after the Sabbath. These facts are not in contrast. According to recent research on the composition and the nomenclature of old perfumes and spices, there were two ways, one not necessarily excluding the other, of using spices for burials. Spices in very fine and well-mixed powders, or migma, the word used by John, who was an eyewitness, and spices mixed in oil, or sakte. There are two further reasons to suggest that Nicodemus used the powdered spices, or migma. First, the very short time available to accomplish their aim. Secondly, if they had anointed the unwashed body, which was covered in blood, sweat, and dust, the oily mixture, the sakte, would have stuck to the linen, the skin, and the wounds, so that it would have been impossible for the women to wash the body ritually on Sunday morning. Moreover, the ritual anointings of the corpse were permitted only after the seven ritual washings. This explains why so large an amount of spices was bought to be sprinkled all around in the tomb, in order to preserve the corpse until Sunday morning.
Galenus, Aetius, Dioscorides, and others scientific and medical authors
of this period tell us that aloes and myrrh were used for burial rites because of their antiseptic and desiccating qualities.
Vim sicandi citra mordacitatem.
Aloes, they say, dry the skin without burning it. If we consider the marks of wounds which cover the body, we should refer to the Roman custom of the days. We have a great deal of information concerning the punishment of scourging.
Perret, in his book Catacombes de Rome, gives a very clear reproduction of a flagrum, flagellum, scorpio, plumbata,
various instruments designed for punishments of different gravity or even for executions. These instruments were found in the Roman catacombs, and consequently their authenticity is certain. A closer examination of the shroud in order to reconstruct the scourging was made by Monsignor Giulio Ricci of the Centro Romano di Sindonologia. It was possible to locate the strokes from the whip by encircling the small area marked by the end of a hypothetical whip. The uniform shape of the small round points would seem to suggest that we are dealing with wounds of a lacerated contused type. It seems that they were produced by pointed pellets of about 12 millimeters. They seem to be in groups of three, consequently made by a flagrum taxillatum with three thongs, the ends of which were weighted with two little pointed balls. There is a tradition concerning a low column to which it is said that the condemned man was attached during the scourging. Many pilgrims,
Pilgrim of Bordeaux, Eteria, Paola,
in the year 333, say they saw it in Jerusalem. At the present moment, it is impossible to discuss the authenticity of the column. However, it is very interesting to note that the marks of the flagrum on the top of the shoulders give us evidence of the bent position of the body. It is possible to see that the blood from the wounds on the top of the shoulders flows toward the thorax. The imprint of the shroud shows us that the whole of the cranium is covered by blood trickles from the occipital area to the bregma. She says that's up here. It shows us that the crowning with thorns, supposed origin of these wounds, was carried out in a typically oriental way, not around the head, but on it. The crowns of oriental kings at that time were like a mitre, which covered the head. If crowning with thorns was in fact carried out in this oriental manner, it would correspond exactly to the John's description, they put it on his head, 19:2. This is a very strange occurrence which went beyond Roman penal procedure. It is historically and archaeologically anomalous,
in apax legomenon,
which can give us decisive help in identifying the man of the shroud. As regards death sentence and execution by crucifixion in Roman times, we may work more on historical information than on archaeological discoveries. However, the documents can also help us to read the imprints on the shroud more exactly. In the dorsal area of the man on the shroud, there are two large contusions. Those condemned to death on the cross had the horizontal piece of the cross tied behind their shoulders on the way to the place of execution. Their arms were outstretched and tied to the wood. There are very careful descriptions of
Licinius Claudius and Justinus.
The vertical part of the cross was always fixed firmly into the ground and used for several executions. It was called the
stipes. The horizontal part of the cross was called the patibulum.
If there were several condemned men, they were fastened to one another by a rope in a strange and characteristic way. A rope from the left calf was attached to the left end of the patibulum. The right end of the patibulum was attached by a long rope to the other condemned man walking ahead in a grim chain. Studying the imprint of the shroud, it has been possible to reconstruct the difficult and painful way, corresponding to the Roman laws, the man of the shroud walked to the place of his execution. On the left leg are the mark of the rope which tied him. The marks of the falls are clearly visible on the face and on the left knee. They agree perfectly with the information collected about Roman
abductio,
the way to the execution place, by eyewitnesses of the time. It should be added, for a better estimation of this study, that Roman historians say
de cruce mori, meaning to die on the cross, and sub cruce, meaning to die on the way.
In Roman law, the two were equivalent. The way the crucifixion was carried out was not an unalterable rite, but was subject to the whims of the executioners. Josephus, an eyewitness of the siege of Jerusalem in the year 70, says that the Romans crucified the Jewish prisoners in various positions as a mark of their contempt. A man was attached to the cross by ropes, or by nails, or by both together. In the case of the man on the shroud, there are the unquestionable marks of nails. We have archaeological information concerning the shape and the form of the nails in use for these executions. I refer to the famous discovery at
Givat HaMidbar in Israel of the tomb of a crucified man named Johanan Bar Ezekiel.
His feet were still held together by a single iron nail, 18 centimeters long, the same shape as the nails used in the buildings at that time for the roof carpentry. The Roman technique of crucifixion permitted the condemned men some desperate movements, provoked by the terrible pain, but above all by the necessity to raise himself up, pushing on his feet to avoid asphyxia. In fact, a man hanging from a cross, there are the famous experiments conducted by Professor Hermann Mueller in Cologne, rapidly suffers severe anoxemia, even if he is simply tied at the wrist by a cloth. The movements on the cross of the man buried at Midgar have been anatomically described by Professor Niku Haas. On the radial bone of the right arm, a large abrasion is still visible. This was due to the rotation of the arm around the nail. The shroud shows us something very similar, although different in the mechanics of the movements, raising up, pushing on the nail in the feet, and drooping down, hanging mainly from the arms. The magnitude of the movements was calculated by the divergence, and consequently the calculation of the angles, between the two different trickles of blood, flowing in two different directions on the left forearm, and two similar trickles flowing in a comparable fashion on the sole of the right foot. On the shroud imprint, we find one further detail which is of interest for an archaeologist, the wound on the right hemithorax. It is a wound from a sharp weapon, 4 centimeters wide. In recent excavations at Jerusalem, many Roman lances used during the famous siege were found. It is interesting to note that the width of the lance at its largest point is 4 centimeters. The foregoing is a summary of the conclusions arrived at by the Rome Center for Shroud Studies on the basis of archaeological and scientific research. I hope this account may have clarified some points and that the studies of all of us may lead to an even greater understanding of what we are perhaps justified in calling the greatest archaeological find of our time.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ciliato. Before we get to the summary papers, I'd like to call for just about a 1 minute stretch break. We can all sort of stand up, stretch our legs, say hi to the person next to you, and then we'll get started. But stay where you are, because we're not going to go out into the other areas. Part of our two-day symposium on the Shroud of Turin. We're now going to have three persons who have been very much involved in the Shroud research. And they will be speaking in turn. Their names are Dr. Rogers from the Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory, then Dr. Jumper, formerly of the Air Force Academy, Colorado, presently of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Air Force Institute of Technology, and Dr. Larry Schwalbe of the Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory. The first speaker, Dr. Ray Rogers, has a, in my opinion, a rather amazing capacity for assimilating information and doing something with it. So I think he was very much a natural to be involved in trying to put everything together as best we can. That is a difficult problem because scientists have or are notorious for disagreeing with each other. And believe me, that happens here within our group just like any other research group as well. So when you try to put together something that everybody can kind of live with, and it's a non-trivial task. All three of the speakers have attempted to do this. Now, there have been a lot of meetings here within the project to try to coordinate all this input into some meaningful fashion. So without any further ado, I'd like to, first of all, introduce to you Dr. Ray Rogers, who will be followed then in turn by the other two speakers.
This one's easy. What I've been talking to people around from various lines of work, some of the press and some of the theologically inclined and the scientists, and we've, as John said, argued our points among ourselves for what seems like lo these many years now, and it occurred to me that what I really wanted to do before we open things to discussion and questions was to explain our philosophical model for the program. I don't think, you know, you've heard the word hypothesis over and over again and lots of little things like that, and I'm almost positive that we aren't all on the same beam. So let me explain a little bit about what it is that we use as our homogenizing philosophical model among us. It's called scientific method. It's a classical method that arose at least back into the Renaissance, and it has very specific elements in it. These are recognized, and that's what makes these elements make an operation scientific. It's not all of the little black boxes, or it's not the tremendous knowledge in libraries or anything like this of any given person. It's scientific method, a philosophical approach to things. It's the thing that allows us as scientists to decouple our personal opinions from the observations and the hard facts of any sort of an operation. It isn't really valid to walk up to somebody and ask him what his personal bent in religion or anything like that is if he is practicing scientific method. And you can check it by the elements that he tells you of his program. Okay, what are some of these elements then? The first one, of course, is to state the problem, to identify the goals. Now, that sounds very easy, but what are the problems and what are the realistic goals that can be managed from something like the Shroud Project? Now, science can attack anything that can be observed in a reproducible, reliable way. And the Shroud, unlike ghosts and UFOs and Bigfoot and things like that, can be demonstrated to exist. It's there. It's a material object. So it's perfectly scientifically all right to do a scientific study on the Shroud. You can observe it and you can try to explain it. That can be then the goal. The problem is to observe it and try to explain why it looks the way it does to you currently. You can't say anything about how you think it might have looked a long time ago unless you've got data that allows you to extrapolate. Can't do anything else. You can try to explain why it is the way it is now. To test its authenticity, we can't even agree on what authenticity is. All we can do is try to explain the way it looks now. Okay, number two is to assemble all of the pertinent data. Things have been done before, it's been observed before, get all of the data together, and now you run into another one of the problems. What is pertinent data? It's fairly obvious that the sorts of things like the Gilberts and Schwalbe and so on have presented, you know, black box type operations that don't have personal opinions. All you do is write down the numbers and you present them. Okay, that's pertinent data. Now, what about somebody's subjective observation of it? I think I saw something on it that would have proved Ian's theories in history or anything like that. What about gospel accounts? Are these pertinent data? No two people are going to agree on what is pertinent data, and a lot of the arguments among the individuals involved in the program and in any program in science revolve around what are pertinent data. That has to be settled before you can go on. And then on number three, you derive hypotheses. All these are imaginings of how could it have happened. Whatever the goal is, how could that observation exist? You put these all down And it's very important to use a classical method known as the method of multiple working hypotheses. The worst thing a scientist can do is to choose one hypothesis, dig in, and protect it to the death. You have to use multiple working hypotheses, and this is certainly one place not to exercise a closed mind. You can cast any kind of a hypothesis you want. With a shroud, you can say, I believe that that was painted in the Black Forest by elves. And that is a perfectly legitimate hypothesis to propose, and you'd better test it right along with all the others. Okay, get your group together and try to get as many hypotheses as you can. It's an open-ended game, and there's another problem in science. You can never prove that you have identified all of the hypotheses. We may have missed hundreds of them that are important to this program. Then you have to make your observations. You have to make the observations based on your hypotheses. You design the observations to test the hypotheses. This was one of our problems with the shroud. We had observations that were reported to us before we went to Turin. We read everything we could find. We got the photographs from Pia and Henriet, and we looked at them and tried to generate as many hypotheses as we could and then design the observations to test them. You had to test, for example, Pierre Arcis, it's a painting. So the X-ray radiography, that's a way you look for paintings, variations in paintings. A lot of the things that we designed in the way of observations came down hard on hypotheses that turned out to be intrinsically weak. But you design your observations to test the hypotheses. And then you test the hypotheses against all of the data. Sometimes some of the data fall. If you've got something that's a little shaky in the way of information, you may prove by other observations it's no good and you have to throw it out. But if you can shoot any of your hypotheses down, get rid of them. Don't sit there and protect them. Just throw them out. Keep the ones that are the most probable and keep testing them. That's where you get your objectivity, and it's testable objectivity. You can show other people what you're doing and they can say, oh, you're full of beans or something. Then, when you've gotten maybe one or a few hypotheses left, you can make predictions on the basis of those hypotheses and do experimentation. Just like Sam Pellicori. He said, I think that if it was the result of a latent image process and accelerated aging sorts of things, that I can achieve the same kind of spectral characteristics by, and then he tries a whole bunch of things. And that is your experimental test for the system. You can extrapolate, you can use all kinds of bits of evidence to test your observations. And this is exactly what we have been trying to do since the very beginning. And the little isolated pieces that you have seen and have heard reported are bricks in the wall that we're trying to build, and now we'll try to give you an idea of what we think the wall looks like, and feel free to shoot holes in it. That's what everybody should do. Don't leave any stone unturned if you can turn it. It's fun in games. Throw everything at it you can. Shall we put the wall together?
Believe it or not, yesterday, I had a paper I was going to read. As the days evolved, I'm down to a couple of pieces of paper with some sketchy notes which I changed 2 minutes ago. It reminds me of a joke I saw some time ago with BC in it, a cartoon strip. This guy is sitting listening to this guy talking, and the sun's coming up, and then it's high noon, and then the sun's going down. He says, are there any questions? And BC says, could you repeat that? And that's what I feel like I have to do here. But I'm not going to repeat it, because I think this morning we had a group of papers which went all the way as far as they could go. People said what was on their mind. All I want to do is remind you of a few things that we've done. If I could have the first slide, please, and the house lights down a bit.
No, thank you, that's not it. That's not the slide. Would you take that off, please? It should be a color picture of the...
Four from there.
Vern, would you go up, please, if we have problems? No, that's not it. Not it. Advance four times, please. Stop. Back up. Okay, focus that. Now, this is the subject of our observation, and as you know and you've heard over the past few days, we did a certain battery of tests to try and find out what was on the cloth. The battery of tests were the photographic imaging, which consists